It was actually, I didn't anticipate this, because when you talked, and you particularly talked about the blueberries in Ukraine, I didn't expect there would be so much laughter about it, at human ingenuity. I think that was quite interesting, actually, because, you know, we talk so much about the human infrastructure, and it kind of connected to one of the questions I had for you of what makes a terrible story? To whom is it terrible? Who benefits from it, and who loses? Who loses out? It's a very difficult question, I think. You know, but yes. It's very it's because you know you mentioned boom towns in Ukraine. People make a living after the terrible disaster, at the same time spreading radioactivity around the planet. What is terrible?
I think. What biologists working in Chernobyl have found, we'll just start with the small birds that have a short lives, is that not only there are only a few species, but those that there are have less than half the lifespan of other birds of their species elsewhere. So because you can see how quickly tumors develop in them, that this radioactivity is not good for people's lives. Mm. And I'm going to guess that's also true with the humans, even though it's easier to see it in birds because they have such short lives. Mm. I think one of Kate Brown's stories about humans from that area, which just has had a huge impression on me, was visiting a family where all the children except one have very bad cancers. Mm. And the one who doesn't, and the family said he only ate junk food. Mm. He only bought processed junk food. He wouldn't eat regular food. Mm. And so that's the one kid who's not dying at this point in their family. So I think some of the features of what I'm calling terrible stories are that they cascade from one form of life to another, and that the kinds of interconnections among species that have made livability possible for humans and our companions, that it ricochets back and forth. And radioactivity is a wonderful example of something that just doesn't stay in a single species, but moves across species. I mean, in the same way, in the plastic bag example, that point in there was we're all eating plastic. If our animals are eating plastic, we're eating plastics too.
Mm. Yes, not just through milk, dairy cows in India, but in plastic bottles and the water that we drink and so on and so on. Yeah. How, and I just also looking at the examples of representation now, and you have the images are quite mute, aren't they? I mean, if you just present something, you need to work a lot at images. Don't, I mean, I found that when, you know, just see some of these examples, it all benefits from knowing species, histories, looking into different disciplines, sourcing lots of different information. That's how do you think that's gonna? That's, and there's so many different ways of doing it. How do you think that would work in the digital storytelling? That's sort of one question. But also, you've collected so many stories. How do they come to you, these stories?
Well, let me start with the representation, because I think I really loved the images that you showed. And to think about making an extinct animal with your hand is both a kind of tribute to the animal and a moment of incredible sadness, in a way that only that all that's left is the human hand and its ability to pretend to be these animals. But the animal itself, the inspiration for it, is
gone.
It's
the mere shadow.
Yes. So I found it very effective as a way of talking about what we lose when a species has gone extinct, that we can, I mean, as the Yongwu artist was saying, you know, we can still dance for the guano. That's that lizard that you saw in the painting, that we can dance for the guano, but the guano is gone because the cane toads have poisoned them. And what that points out to me is how important the, you know, I think I stressed the part that has to do with scientists and humanists in the large sense that includes social scientists, but that that artists or people who think about representation are really at the center of this too. It seems to me that the challenge of the Anthropocene in general is how are you going to tell these stories in an effective way that might mean that the kind of witnessing that we're doing makes a difference. So there's many different answers to that question, but it's impossible to study the Anthropocene and not think about it. So anything from modeling and big data on the one hand to these little poignant kinds of stories are ways of trying to make representations that matter.
It's very interesting with the great orgs. I was struck by Marcus Coates' divergence of approaches, you know, of the very abstract sculpture of, you know, this is a great abstraction of species, the way we understand the term species. So we measure it out, we taxonomize it and so on. And then the relating the stories of the extinction. But what I find quite striking is with a lot of artists who get into these subject areas is they work for a long time on certain ideas. And so does he. So he, as I just mentioned, he's been to Newfoundland and he works with the community there where still types of orcs, so the razorbill orcs, for example. And with Marcus Coates, it always strikes me that he's got a very particular humor, which, as I found in your talk as well just now. And so he works with the community there, and they're trying to figure out an apology on behalf of their ancestors, of the settler community there in the 19th century, and they're trying to figure out what is the wording of this apology to the great orc who's gone extinct. So it became a really interesting work. He filmed it, and so they formulated an apology, and they said, well, an apology is important because we need to sort of think forward. We need to not want this to happen again, and we need to think about it. We sort of, it was a cohabitation with species that they were really expressing through this apology. And then you had the mayor of this small settlement, the megaphone, shouting it out into the, onto the, onto the...
That's really interesting.
That's kind of interesting. So I just love it from, you know, an abstraction to this terrible story of the killer. So that's why I put it in, because I think it's a terrible story of violence towards a species, human, towards a species, towards making it with your hands, being that species that gone extinct, to expressing something in words. And then being in the environment as well, in which you express that apology and that sorrow, which I think these are all really interesting ideas that I think possibly could sort of come into the storytelling, digital or other, around the explication of the evidencing of these stories, and you know, what you would do with it in the future. So if you collect those stories, you do having a sort of forensic perspective onto environments, I guess, but then what do you do with them for the future? How will it activate?
Well, I think that's where the digital architecture, which is very much in process and very much not yet a product, comes in, that we want to present them in a way, I mean, that's charismatic, that people will use them, that the dream for this Feral Atlas is that it's a teaching tool, it's a research tool in the sense of sparking a kind of research imagination that's at that intersection point where human histories and non-human histories come together, and that it's also kind of fun to play with. So we were hoping to pull in audiences across that axis to think about these feralities, and as I said, to look at the cases that we didn't have. And actually, let me address the question of where these cases come from. And of course, we don't just find them on the street, that we are trying to convince scientists and humanists and artists that we know to participate in this project. And as you heard, it's people who've done some primary research on these phenomena, so we're trying not to make this a kind of simple journalism where you've just read an article and you want to write about it. But when possible, to have somebody who can talk about the procedures through which they learned about these problems. And I'm saying this because we got this nice big audience here, and if any of you, whatever your walk of life, have things that might fit, we still, you know, there are still really important stories that we haven't put in here, so please write me if you think you've got one from your own research, whatever meaning of research you have. So I can't promise you we'll include it, but I would really like to hear from you if you got one, because I think there's tons of stories we haven't gotten to yet.
Mm. What I was interested in when you talked about the plantation scene, and yes, you had to show the image of the plantation, and you had the weevil, and then you also had the person who was enslaved or forced labor in it. I was just wondering, because humans have treated humans very badly, and I think often it gets forgotten in the Anthropocene discourses of how the what the effects were on humans and enslavement in particular. Do you think it should figure more strongly, or I mean the human aspect is, I mean, it is somewhere in there, but you concentrating mostly on non-human species so far?
Well, we're really trying to entangle the human and non-human features of it. But of course, stressing that this is not about the kind of will to kill aspect of human whatever, but rather these infrastructures. But there's plenty of places where the mistreatment of humans and the mistreatment of non-humans go together. And in fact, we're considering about the boll weevil using famous kind of folk song written by an American blues singer, Leadbelly, back during the period when the boll weevil was hitting those fields, and African Americans, as a result, were forced to migrate because the cotton was going broke. They were forced to migrate to the north, so it had huge sociological effects. And the thing about Leadbelly's song, which I'm just tempted to put the song on there, is that it's clear that Leadbelly himself identifies with the boll weevil. The song personifies the boll weevil. It says he was looking for a home. That's the boll weevil. He was looking for a home. And it ends with Leadbelly, who's part of this migration to the north, he was looking for a home. He was looking for a home. So there was a sense where the identification of humans and these feral creatures was an important part of that. We've got an entry from an anthropologist who worked with scavengers in Kampala, the capital city of Uganda, who worked in waste dumps collecting stuff. And there, it's you know, one of the examples where it isn't a terrible story, but a kind of good story where exotic species, marabou storks, have gathered on these waste dumps to eat all the organic materials, and the scavengers actually really like the storks because they get rid of a lot of the organic garbage and allow the scavengers to look for the stuff they really want, which is the durable materials that they're going to find in this waste dump. So the city authorities want to get rid of both the marabou storks and the garbage pickers. Mm-hmm. And so he writes about the identification they have for each other as different kinds of scavengers on the stump. So that would be another example. Mm.
I love to ask you lots more questions, but maybe the audience has got some questions at this point.
Hi, I was just curious, is the Feral Atlas intersecting with like social movements or activist movements? And if so, how do you see it being employed by sort of like mass movements and activists?
I would be delighted to think of some ways. But I don't know the answer to that question. And so maybe you'll have to tell me some ways that movements could use it. I think, as I said, I think there are some practical suggestions. Like, in my opinion, we should abolish the commercial nursery trade because of the kind of plant diseases that it's breeding and sending all over the world. And there's absolutely no reason to send soil all over the world, that every place in the world has soil. So it's an example of a completely practical thing that I hope somebody decides to mobilize around, because trees cannot keep up with the number of diseases that this commercial business is sending their way. That's not an existing movement, but one that I would love to see come up into being, and sometimes movements come up very quickly. I think the big movement is that to do something about the Anthropocene, and maybe it's worth one way of suggesting how I'm using that with this patchy Anthropocene. There's patches of what a colleague of mine calls Holocene fragments, that is, pieces of our world where interconnections have not been torn apart. And so one of the kinds of movements I'd love to see also is to hold on to those Holocene fragments while we've got them. So I think there's a variety of ways that people might be involved in this, from the tiny to the large. And it's that kind of project that's meant both to tell you, as I did, to check in your freezer at the wild blueberries that I had in there, which in my freezer said packed in Maine, which means they could have come from the Ukraine, and to think about what are you planning to do about that, to opening a big imagination for kinds of mobilizations that maybe we might begin, and with connections across the different places. That's the best I can do right now, but I'd love to hear more from you at some point.
Hi, here. Okay. I'm a media studies scholar by training, but I'm not gonna ask something about teaching actually in digital narratives. I'm not gonna ask about that. But I have a question about two discourses, and one is picking up from what you were just talking about, the soil that's being transported. It's the discourse around invasive species. Now, I work mainly or come from critical migration scholarship, and if I look at the discourses on invasive species, there's a lot that reminds us on, let's say, problematic racist discourses around migration. Now, of course, it's very easy. If you look at the example of Hawaii, it makes sense that they're trying to, they have I read in Stefan Holmreich's book, Alien Ocean, one of those examples of how Hawaii tries to not guard themselves from invasive species, or the cargo, the freight water law that has just been passed. But on the other hand, it is, it's complicated to look at invasive species in that same logic as we address migration. So I'm just curious what you make of that entanglement. And the other thing is taxonomy. The Natural History Museum here in Berlin, just a couple of months ago, I think it was a public event or something, I read an article that they're saying we need, as a Natural History Museum, take a stand in biodiversity. And one of the areas that we need is taxonomy. It's one of the areas in research that's very much underfunded, that a lot of universities are getting rid of. Now, on the other hand, taxonomy has a history in, labeling the world, making it, claiming it, mapping it as part of a whole imperial process. So again, taxonomy seems to be now the one of the propositions of how to work towards biodiversity. And again, but it's also a highly problematic concept. So two entangled stories that I don't know how to make sense of. Thank you.
Well, of course, you're raising two of the big bugaboos of humanists who don't want to work with natural scientists. So let me try and address them and open them up and see how well I do. On the invasive species question, it's very important to stay close to the materialities rather than thinking about the words alone. So it's important to remind us all that species is not invasive just because it's exotic, that is, because it's another place. It's only considered invasive when it kills off indigenous ecologies. So it only enters the term invasive when it's killing something else. I find it very useful to use the term of historian Virginia Anderson, creatures of empire, that most of the species that we know as invasive came with human projects of invasion and conquest. That they're creatures of empire because they're part of settler colonialism, in most cases, projects of inhabiting indigenous space. And so we need to take a look at the kind of violence they're doing against humans as well as non-humans in some of the places that they've been brought. And certainly, for example, in the European invasion of the New World, which is the kind of beginning of the discussion. So while I would really like to avoid any implication that this is an anti-immigrant kind of rhetoric, it seems to me important to have advocates for all of the many local native species and ecologies that are being killed off through projects of empire. And that I think unless we want to live in a world with just a few weedy companions, these feral kinds of products, we're going to have to think about the indigeneity, not just for humans, but also for non-humans, as something maybe that deserves some special kinds of rights. So that's my answer to the indigeneity, to the invasiveness question. I would love to discuss it more. This taxonomy, I similarly think you've hit on something that many humanists are worried about. I do think that there are colonial histories of botany, zoology, and many of the other practices of nature making that came out of Europe. And just yesterday, for example, I was in a discussion in Hamburg about birds of paradise. And it turns out that almost all the birds of paradise have the names of Central European dignitaries that they were named because of these explorations out there. And it's a nice example of where naming can be part of an imperial exercise. But to me, it's really important to not to condemn the ability of humans to know something about non-humans around us, in which naming is helpful, as in the same way that when we name each other, it can be a way of getting to know each other. And I think it's a terrible risk that we're taking right now in not funding kinds of science that allow any knowledge or expertise on the world around us, that because it's very prestigious to study, for example, molecular genetics, you might have a scientist who's worked all his life on a particular pathway in a starfish without being able to identify that starfish if he ran over it on the beach. So I think we're in trouble when we don't even know what's out there in the world. And it's not just a matter of counting and cabinets of curiosity. It's because it turns out that none of us can live, human or non-human, without a huge number of relational dynamics across species. And we don't even know what they are. We're learning every day new ways that, you know, you can't have plants without fungi, you can't digest your food without bacteria. But all these interactions are absolutely essential. And to the extent that we stop caring about all these other organisms around us, we're in big trouble.
I have a question that here.
I'm just can't find it. Okay.
How much of your research is about agriculture and horticulture? Is it kind of the meeting field of science or nature and human being, human culture?
In my own research, is that the question?
Yes.
Well, you know, I spent kind of the last 10 years working on fungi, and I kind of stumbled into it. and became fascinated, became somebody who thought fungi was really important. And I started with the book that's supposedly out there with a very beneficial fungus, beneficial in a number of ways. It's incredibly valuable, so it makes the people who pick it have a source of livelihood. And in Japan, where it's enjoyed, it's considered a great gift. And in the forests, where it's allowing trees to grow in rather difficult circumstances where there aren't a lot of nutrients or water around, it makes forests possible. But in that process of writing about this, then I started, you know, people started accusing me of being a little too optimistic. So I did think, all right, let's take a look. So I moved into pathogenic fungi. And it turns out that pathogenic fungi have become much worse as a problem in the world since the plantation, because there's nothing like a plantation to create pathogenic fungi that weren't there before. There was a whole blight of maize, for example, where they changed one gene in the maize, and of course all the fungi just flocked in there to kill it all off. So from there, I started thinking about the plantation as a kind of ecological simplification that helps to create the Anthropocene with all of its problems. I mean, I know I'm not tackling climate change here, but there's a whole lot that comes out of the plantation. And I feel the benefit of all the social humanist research that's been done on plantations, including the ways that plantations were the models for industrial factory work, because they showed you that if you disciplined humans and non-humans and made them into these little alienated units, you could get a whole lot of production happening for distant investors who didn't really care what was happening on the ground. So plantations seem to me, and still seem to me, a really good to think with structure for understanding the Anthropocene, including its patchiness, including its unevenness. I don't know if this is addressing your questions, but conceptually, I do think industrial agriculture is really great to think with what are some of the problems that we address today.
So the second question is, plantation, you mean mechanic agriculture, the big one, not every field, not every nursery, not every forest?
Correct. I don't mean every field. I had the privilege of doing my very first fieldwork as an anthropologist with a group of folks who did a kind of agroforestry in the rainforests of Borneo, where they planted many, many crops, and they were worked on the kind of synergies of different plants, and when they were finished with a plot, it returned to forest for, say, 15 or 20 years before they used it as a plot again. I think that's completely different than the kind of monocrop deserts that we've created that are now the center of industrial agriculture.
I have a, it's more of a comment, I think, but, and it's more about the storytelling and the place of artists in this. While you were talking, I was thinking, why is it so difficult to, in these kinds of storytellings, why is it so difficult to find this kind of balance between, on the one hand, loss, the story of loss and being desperate and sad, and on the other hand, the story of hope and love, and that something nice might happen. And I was thinking to myself, because I think I find myself right now in this situation, that usually we tend to think that those are mutually exclusive, as if first you need to grieve, like as if there were two steps, like first you need to grieve and then maybe you can start hoping again for something nice. But now our situation maybe is that we need to grieve and hope at the same time. And that's why those stories maybe are so difficult to tell, because we always, we don't know how to put these two aspects of the thing together, and we somehow have to. And so my question or my remark was about the artists you talked about. I felt that they were more on the side of telling the story of loss and helping us to grieve about extinct species, etc. And I was wondering, because I think there are other artists that maybe can tell also the other aspect of the story, or focus on the other aspect of the story and trying to tell stories of collaboration and interspecies collaboration and getting more attuned to animal worlds, etc. And I was wondering what is the maybe the greatest power of art in this, maybe is it, does it have to do both, both at the same time, or I don't know.
That's your choice.
That's my question. I only selected a few examples here in order to emphasize the intermediality between that's required, I think, for adequate storytelling of revealing the complexities of histories, of loss. There's hope, I think. I only explained it, but I didn't show it in the Marcus Coates' work. You know, when I went further, you know, he's still pursuing the project about the great orc, you know, of having revealed that very violent, that sad story about the extinction of this last pair and how that happened, why that happened. But now with this follow-on piece, which he's doing at the moment, you know, where he's sort of trying to sort of galvanize a community group who is local to that situation, of trying to formulate an apology, because they think, well, we think it's important, there are other species here, they're related, we need to look after them, we need to care for them. And I guess that's what you just described really well, of, you know, there's this moment of turning, you know, there's this realization, something's happened, let's stop, let's make a break, you know, maybe even with that abstract piece of, you know, what are we doing here? Is this an abstraction? Is this something that relate to? What is our experience? What is our empathy? And it was very interesting, because I think it's quite important of how, what our horizon of experience is. How far can you go back in order to care for something? I think that's quite important. So is this in living memory? Is this in described memory? Maybe this was something that came out through Daniel Boyd's work. You know, he refers to the events 1788, which completely changed the Australian continent. You know, the peoples of Australia, all of those cultures were eradicated. Other, you know, non-human species were eradicated. So there's a great loss around that, irreparable, terrible stories that you know that are not even told really, because nobody really cares about the indigenous population. But to him, there's what is, I guess, which comes out of different disciplines. There's sort of an indisciplinarity that comes out of it. It's sort of a hybridization of knowledge, which he, in his case, embraces quite strongly. So I think it's very different from the artist that you show, the indigenous Australian. He's very much sort of an urban indigenous Australian artist, and he looks at very many different cultures that now sort of come into Australia, that have come out of Aboriginal culture and flowed into other cultures. And so I think an inevitable process of hybridization around cultures or species, which is, I guess, also is a qualifier for the stories that you look at, of, you know, how is infrastructure that we create, what are the consequences, what are the impacts? And I think it needs very nuanced qualifying around all these stories. And I think that's where the hope is, as it were, for these stories. But it's only by revealing them and by looking quite closely and by evidencing them and almost having a forensic process that we can work on them.
Can I say two quick things about the question? One is, one of the artists that helped us think in the Feral Atlas project is Maya Lin, who has a digital project called What is Missing, which really emphasizes not only the loss, the extinction, but also the kinds of collaborations that are involved in trying to work to keep the animals and plants that we've got right now. The second is that I happen to come of age in the, you know, in that part of the late 20th century when lots of social movements against racism, sexism, imperial war, and things like that involved social anger, that it was precisely because we were so angry at everything that was wrong that we had hope. And so I would love it if, you know, back to the question about how to mobilize, if the kinds of stories that we were telling were stories that made people so furious that we lived in the world that we do, that they felt like there was something worth living for to fix some of these problems.
Hi, here. Thank you so much. This is a question for both of you. I wanted to ask, it was sort of mentioned before already, where do you see in your work the role of natural history museums in these kinds of discussions, particularly for the Feral Atlas that seems to be much more sort of democratically or network-like? And also in terms of thinking about this as this public institution, educational institution, sort of capturing nature and, you know, the Natural History Museum, but then also the very, very human biased space where, you know, this sort of like somewhat hierarchic or uneven setup. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. Obviously, it's a place to go to, you know, to I suppose to look at nature in comfort. I mean, I'm very much in favor of, you know, you should actually be out there much more. You should actually be doing field work, and you know, it's just the way of noticing things that, you know, and also, you know, I showed the image of the ecologist within the forest holding up something. You know, how do you start creating sort of a frame around it that you pay attention to something, that you do you notice something? And I guess when you go to Natural History Museum, a lot of that work has been done for you. And you know, with all the baggage, and you know, there was a really good comment here on imperialism and racism that's sort of embodied. And so these collections obviously come with so much historical baggage that sometimes really quite difficult to strip all of this away. So where have they come from? Why were they collected? How have they been named? Why? How are they displayed? You know, all of these are all cultural activities, which is really hard sometimes to work through. And which I found the project by Elizabeth Price so rewarding, because she said, well, if I just take a species and I just look at all of these different histories which collect around it and I just reveal them, it tells me so much about human and this particular species relations. So it, you know, it reveals something completely other than the scientific study in itself, obviously, and then the scientific study goes on at the Natural History Museum. So I think it's you have to work quite hard at it at Natural History Museums, but I think it's really very rewarding experience. However, I think it can never replace to be outside and be in the field and just to discover things there. And that's quite difficult, and I think, but there are organizations that do it, and I think I would always encourage it to do it. First of all, in a way, before something comes into the Natural History Museum, where it, you know, it acquires always something quite encyclopedic, sort of this, the urge to have a bit of everything and just to have this comparison. I guess it talks to your comparison, doesn't it? It's really helpful for that too, just in order to understand species a bit better. But yeah, I mean, just thinking, I'm sorry, I keep on thinking about your comment here about the sort of implied racism in terminologies and so on, and just thinking about Berlin in particular as a place where it, you know, such a nexus of mobility of people and plants, say, you know, of things come from you know, through railways, usually plants were also transported around, not just ships, and so you can have different terms around, and I guess here of the whole field of Stadt Natur is really important, which try to develop quite different terms, which are the term of the arriving species, so the Adventist species, or in English you use the term ruderal species. So there are alternative terminologies that you can use in order to describe how species end up in one place, and how you can make space for them, and how you can, in urban environment, leave, particularly in the case of Berlin, leave them not designed, like it happened a lot after the war, where just places were just left. And so I think, to me, that's actually a hopeful story, thinking about it, you know, of making space for species by not urbanizing everything, and by also, hopeful is also that people think about different terminologies. But that's also something you can see in the Natural History Museum. So I think a Natural History Museum has got all of these layers, and it keeps on reinventing itself as well. So you can read these discussions through looking at the Natural History Museum too.
Can I add two quick things?
Yeah.
One is, one of the clearest memories from my childhood was when my family took a trip to the New York Natural History Museum, and I saw the diorama of the saber-toothed tiger. It was so thrilling to me. I thought, wow, that's a wonderful thing. And so there's something the natural history museums can do, at least for me as a kid, that did invoke curiosity. And the second is that I just got back this morning from a really interesting exhibit at the Hamburg Natural History Museum, which the reason I liked it was that it combined colonial critique and this sense of wonder and care and love. And it's the one by Anna-Sophie Springer and Etienne Turpin called Disappearing Legacies, The World is Forest. And I thought it was really rather beautiful in how they put the colonial critique in there, but didn't use it to abolish the museum, but to try and use it in a productive way.
Yeah, I'd like to ask one more time about what we're calling indigenous cultures or indigenous approaches, and without romanticizing too much about what we are calling indigenous approaches. The question is, in terms of storytelling, it has a significance in not just communicating, but inspiring and motivating and so on. And asking sort of a question, whereas probably most of us are afraid or even angry of this post-factual move. Yeah, science is not necessarily good. We're not interested in facts. It's an interesting thing to consider going back to an indigenous storytelling, which wasn't based on facts in the same way we think about them either. But is there a place for this now? I mean, in terms of storytelling, which has this history in indigenous stories, yeah, the, you know, creation stories, or you know, how did a group of people get somewhere, mm-hmm. Where people have been laughing about them for the last few centuries? Is there something that we can get out of that that might help us in telling stories, mm-hmm. in a way that move people, in a way that facts and scientific reports maybe don't?
Well, to me, in the places that I've known best, working with indigenous people, people have very close natural history observations of the world. So at the level of teaching us what's going on, that's the first level. So it's not all creation myths. It's actual practical observations about the world and what happens when you interact with it in certain kinds of ways. It's where I think we need to look, on the one hand, at the specificity of those stories, which have their own premises often about how the world is composed, and to look at the translational practices of which they're a part. So to me, I want to have it both ways. I want the indigenous storytelling to have some kind of principles, aesthetic, intellectual, or whatever, that mold it and still have connections. So yesterday I got to give a talk at this Hamburg display about birds, and I was watching Western bird watchers working with indigenous people on birds, and they both knew a lot about birds, but they didn't always agree about what was happening with those birds, and yet they had a lot in common. So there were spaces of overlapping curiosity, even as they drew apart in certain ways.
I think that had to be the last question, actually. We were supposed to vacate the building at 9:00, is that right? Yeah.
Well,
thank you for coming, and thank you, Anna. Yeah.